Hey, good morning, everybody. Good morning. Welcome to Faith Community Church. And if this is one of your very first times or your very first time, a special welcome to you and good morning, everyone joining us online as well this morning. We're walking through a letter in the New Testament together called 1 Corinthians. So I'll invite you to turn there with me in your Bibles or follow along on your phones this morning. We're going to be in chapter 4. If you'd like to borrow a Bible from under the chairs in front of you, we'll be on page 953 this morning. Now, I know that every week we're together, we cover a little bit of the background of 1 Corinthians, and we do that because we have friends that are visiting with us for the first time every week. But also, for those of you who've been here, you know, throughout the series, there are still a few things that would just be really helpful to keep in mind as we read together today, okay? So, to keep you awake, we're going to do this in quiz format this morning. Okay, is everybody ready? If you are here for the very first time, you get 1,000 points. Keep track of your own points just for being here. You're excused from the quiz. For the rest of you, here we go. 1 Corinthians is a letter written by the Apostle Paul. Very good. You get that's 100 points. That's all you get. Written by the Apostle Paul to a church in the ancient city of Corinth. And Corinth was a competitive, judgmental place. It was obsessed with appearances and status. Corinth was about looking good. One author puts it this way. They were infatuated with sophisticated teachers. They prized form over content, prestige above humility, stoicism above passion, philosophical wisdom over frank confessions of ignorance. They valued rhetoric above truth and money over people and reputation over integrity. Corinth was all about how you looked and your status. And when God called these Corinthians to Jesus, which is just amazing to think about, they brought all of that with them into the church, okay? So if you're new to the church, just a heads up, the church is not an ivory tower lined with marble statues, but a hospital for people recovering from sin, okay? So if you've ever had the thought, man, the church is so messed up. Well, yeah, welcome to you. You'll fit right in. Paul is writing this letter to show these Corinthians, look, your divisions and your judgmentalism and your preoccupation with how you look to each other is rooted in what he calls the wisdom of the world, okay? For 1,000 points now, we've said this like 5 weeks in a row, okay? What is at the center of the wisdom of the world? 1,000 points. This series is going really well. You. The wisdom of the world is going to make you and your stuff and your issues the center of your world. And the wisdom of God is going to seek to make what the center of your world? Jesus, God, the grace of God. Okay, I would have accepted any of those answers, okay, for 1,000 points. The wisdom of God is going to make him and what he has done for us in Jesus the center and foundation of every part of your life. So you got chapter 4 out in front of you, okay? You got it? Say, I got it. Okay, if you would just glance up the page, this is where we left off. Chapter 3, verse 21, he says, so no more boasting in people, okay? No more boasting in you, no more boasting in anyone else. All things are yours, he says. The world and life and death and the present and the future, all are yours, and you are Christ's, and Christ is God's. Now today, Paul's going to take that central foundation and apply it to himself and another young pastor named Apollos and say to the Corinthians, look, this is what it looks like when you know that everything is yours and that you are Christ and Christ is God's. Okay? Here we go. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 1. This is how one should regard us. He's talking about himself and Apollos and the other apostles now. This is how one should regard us, as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required of stewards that they be found faithful. But with me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself, For I'm not aware of anything against myself, but I am not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore, do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes of the heart. Then each one will receive his commendation from God. I've applied all these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit, brothers, that you may learn by us not to go beyond what is written, and that none of you may be puffed up in favor of one over another. For who sees anything different in you? What do you have that you did not receive? And if you received it, why do you boast as though you did not receive it? Already you have all you want. Already you've become rich. Without us, you've become kings. And would that you did reign, so that we might share the rule with you. For I think that God has exhibited us apostles as last of all, like men sentenced to death, because we have become a spectacle to the world, to angels, and to men. We are fools for Christ's sake, but you are wise in Christ. We are weak, but you are strong. You're held in honor, but we in disrepute. To the present hour, we hunger and thirst. We're poorly dressed and buffeted and homeless, and we labor, working with our own hands. When reviled, we bless. When persecuted, we endure. When slandered, we entreat. We have become and are still like the scum of the world, the refuse of all things. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Okay, so what does Paul say to these Corinthians who are so preoccupied with appearances and status? What kind of an example does he give us? He says, this is how you should regard us, as servants of Jesus and stewards of the mysteries of God. And it's required that we should be found faithful. So 2 weeks ago, if you were here, Paul was saying, you're God's field, and we're just the farmer. Okay, you're so preoccupied with us, you're comparing us to each other, you're trying to make us a part of your, you know, your game. We're just farmers. But God gives the growth. It's all of grace. See, Paul is constantly trying to move grace back to the center of our lives. Then last week he said, you're God's temple, we're just the builders. And it's God's presence that makes you special. And this week he says, you know, a steward is someone in charge of an important household. Anybody watch Downton Abbey? It's one of my secret sins. I love Downton Abbey. This is Carson. If you know who Carson, okay, I lost half of you, but Carson, okay? We're stewards of God's household. Now, being the steward of a household came with real authority, but you're still just a servant. You know, servants are, they're designed to be invisible. That's what Paul says they are. And you're God's household. And what makes you special is that he's the head of the household. Otherwise, you're just people. He says a household servant has to be found faithful by the head of the household. But he says in verse 3, I don't care what you think of me. I'm paraphrasing. I don't care what you think of me. You're not the boss of me. Right? Now, I assume if you were, is anyone here under the age of 50? Anyone under the age of 50? Okay. I would assume if you were nurtured on the self-esteem movement of the 80s and 90s and the early 2000s as I was, are there any other millennials in the room this morning? You won't admit it. It's okay. Are there any other millennials in the room this morning? Thank you. Praise God. It's not our fault. Look, the world did this to us. So if you were nurtured on the self-esteem movement, you know, of the 80s and 90s and so forth, let's see if you can finish this sentence. Okay, are you ready? It doesn't matter what you think of me. It only matters what I think of me. Good job. Okay. Now, if you were nurtured on the identity movement of the last 10 years, so Generation Z and younger, where you have an innate identity, right, that needs to be discovered and nurtured and affirmed, let's see if you can finish this sentence. Are you ready? It doesn't matter who you say I am. It only matters who I say that I am. So I would imagine that for about half the room, verse 3 resonates very deeply. You're not the boss of me, and I don't care what you think of me. If you're over 50, I don't know what your issues were, but I know you have them, okay? The wisdom of the world will always try to make you the center of your life. And the Bible agrees to a point. Verse 3, it doesn't matter what other people think of us. We should not be living according to what other people think of us. But what he says next is totally off our radar. He says, in fact, and wouldn't this be great? I don't even care what I think of me. It's a trap to say to people, don't worry about what other people think of you. Just set your own standard. Well, how many people live up to their own standard? Unless you have really low standards. If you have low standards, would you raise your hand this morning? I just have really low standards, so I'm doing really well. It's a trap. The wisdom of the world transfers our slavery from the opinions of others just to our own opinion. But we're still a slave. In my very first paid ministry job at UW-Platteville, and I think this is probably true for most people, you know, in their first career jobs. You know, if things were going well, I was doing well. And if things were going poorly, I was moody and devastated, and it's all my fault, and woe is me, and woe to the world that bore me, you know, that type of thing. And I mistook all this for a deep and profound humility. And then I would get angry about the slightest criticism. You know, if someone said something about what I was doing, I would just be totally put off by it, even if I pretended I wasn't. Until one day I remember very vividly my coworker saying to me, "Why does everything have to be about you?" And that's when I realized I had a problem. There's a trap. See, the wisdom of the world makes us slaves to ourselves. Everybody's got to serve somebody, said Bob Dylan. See, people over 50, I got you. Everybody's got to serve somebody. It's just a question of who. Now, one of the answers that the world proposes, you know, to snowflakes like me, is you just need to toughen up. You need thicker skin. And there is some truth to that. Everybody, we're not to be easily offended. We do need a little thicker skin, but thick skin is just another word for calloused. It's just another way to not deal with helpful criticism. It's just another way to deflect the opinions of others and be, you know, king of my own universe. Thick skin is just worldly wisdom. And what Paul offers us is, what if grace were just so thick on your life that when someone came to you with criticism, you'd say, oh, criticism, an opportunity to grow. How many of you do that naturally? Oh, thank you. I'd love to grow. I'd love to learn from you. But if Jesus is, and what he's done for you is just so central to your life, then you can say with Paul, look, your opinion is not going to kill me, but my opinion about me isn't going to kill me either. God is going to judge me. Where does that come from? That kind of thick grace? From what I just said. God is going to judge me. That's a very simple, very old doctrine, and it's at the very center of the Christian faith. Look at all of the legalese in verses 4 and 5. He says, I don't care if I'm judged. That's literally, it's justified. I don't care if I'm justified by you or any other human court. So Paul understands all of us every day are on trial, right? We walk through our lives on trial. In fact, he says, I don't even justify myself. I'm not thereby acquitted. Okay, that doesn't mean I'm always right. I just know that the verdict doesn't rest with me or you or anyone else. It's the Lord who judges me. And in verse 5, he says, he'll do it perfectly. In a world obsessed with how things look, God will judge what nobody sees. He's going to bring to light what's hidden and disclose. This should make you just shudder a little bit. He'll disclose the purposes of your heart to you. How many of you know or figured out already, you don't always know why you do what you do? God will show you. And then, let's just see if you're paying attention, okay? Verse 5, he says, then everyone, each one, will receive his condemnation from God. Is that what it says? It says each one will receive his commendation from God. His praise. Think about this. God will praise you and will honor you. He's going to disclose everything in your heart. And then he's going to praise you and honor you. In Christian circles, Paul is articulating what we call the doctrine of justification by faith. It's very old, and it is at the very center of what we believe as God's people. God removes from me the condemnation and the guilt and the penalty of sin that I deserve, puts it on Jesus, who bears it to the cross, and then I get all of his righteousness and all of his praise and all of his commendation. Justification by faith. And this, what we just read, is justification by faith applied in Paul's real life. I know that God will judge me, and I know the verdict. And he's going to praise me and honor me, but not because of anything I've done. And that makes the soul free. Okay, now if you've been around church for a long time, you know, you might be saying, oh, yep, I know that. Jesus lived for me, he died for me, he rose again for me. Let's move on. No. Several weeks ago, if you were here, we were reading about Christian maturity or eating solid food. You remember that? We said solid food is teaching from God's word that challenges the way we think, it challenges the way we live, it challenges our choices, and it leads to greater maturity and love for God. And it's all centered in the cross and resurrection of Jesus. We said, quote, is a great sermon. You were there. Christian maturity is what happens when the cross becomes larger and even more clear, and when its meaning is pressed into every corner of our hearts. Solid food is not complicated theologies. It's this: Jesus died for my sins, chewed on and mulled over and prayed on, and then applied in our marriage, our relationships, our work, every part of our lives, day in and day out. So this morning, solid food for you is Jesus died for me. God is going to judge me. I know the verdict. He's going to praise me and honor me, but not because of what I've done, but because of what Jesus has done. You take that home and you chew it over all week long and mull it over. Now, and this is what it'll do in your life. Any honest person, whether you're a Christian or not this morning, any honest person would have to acknowledge that the Apostle Paul is among like the top 10 most influential people in the history of the world. I mean, he had such incredible vision and determination and endurance and conviction, and yet he lived with practically no regard for himself. He was totally free. Why? Because what we just read was real to him and had been worked into every part of his life. I just ran across this week. This kind of blew my mind. I don't know if you know who William Wilberforce is. William Wilberforce was the most famous abolitionist, slavery abolitionist in England, and was in the British House of Commons his entire adult life. He worked tirelessly for 30 years to see slavery abolished throughout Great Britain and its empire. And it was a brutal, brutal fight. He was hated by many and yet endured, and actually saw slavery abolished just a few weeks before the end of his life, without a civil war, by the way. And this is what I read this week that just, I was like, you gotta be joking. What sustained him for 30 years was justification by faith. The knowledge that God is his judge. And he already had the verdict. For more than 30 years. He actually wrote a book, okay? This is a career politician writing to his people. And the thesis of the book is, Britain, your problem is you don't understand justification by faith. That's almost an exact, I'm going to read you an exact quote. Here we go. This is from 1797. He writes, the errors and moral failures, he's talking about tolerating slavery. The errors and moral failures of the mass of British Christians is the result of a mistaken conception about the fundamental principle of Christianity. They do not remember that Christianity is a scheme for justifying the ungodly, Romans 4:5. That it is about Christ dying for them when still sinners, Romans 5:6-8. A scheme for reconciling us to God when we were enemies, Romans 5:10. Wilberforce is in the fight of his life to end a wicked practice throughout his empire, and he writes a book about justification by faith. Is it possible, dear brother and sister, that you don't take it seriously enough? That if you're wondering why you don't have the kind of perseverance, the kind of endurance, the kind of joy that is bulletproof when you're criticized, if you're wondering why you're fragile, I would suggest to you this morning, it's because this center of the Christian faith just needs to be worked in some more. If we don't make the grace of God the center of every part of our lives, Paul enumerates three dangers that we're going to run into. Number one, he says, we're going to be puffed up. Take a look at verse 6. I've applied all these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit so that you'd learn not to go beyond what is written. Literally, okay, that means keep your finger in the book. Keep your nose in the book. No one has authority to make judgments about you except God alone. Okay, so get back to the book and don't be puffed up. Some of your translations, maybe they say arrogant or something like that, but puffed up translates a Greek word that is totally unique to Paul in the Bible. No one uses this word except the Apostle Paul, and he uses it almost exclusively with the Corinthians. There's only one other place. Almost exclusively. This is the first of six times, and it's a graphic word, okay? Are you ready? It's the sense of an overinflated, painfully distended organ of your body. Okay, don't raise your hand, but Have you ever had just really painful bloating and gas? That is what he's talking about. You ever seen a cartoon where they put the bellows on the cartoon character and they put, and he floats away? That's the image that Paul has in mind when he uses this particular word. Paul doesn't say you'll be filled up. He says you'll be puffed up. You'll be filled with nothing. It's just emptiness. It's just air. It's a little cliche, okay, but we're seeing it taught right here. There really is a God-shaped hole at the heart of every human being. And if you try to fill it with anything other than what Jesus has done for you, it'll be too small. It's going to rattle around in there and cause you all kinds of problems. How would you know? Okay, how would you know if you're puffed up this morning? I'll tell you, you're comparing yourself to other people. He says it right there. I'm telling you this. I'm applying this to Apollos and I so you'd not be puffed up and, what is it? Start comparing us to each other. That's what, you have this vacuum. If you don't fill it with God, you fill it with something smaller, it's not going to work. And so to fix the problem, you start comparing notes, comparing yourself to other people. Now, C.S. Lewis is such a great guide for us in this, okay? He writes in The Weight of Glory. He talks about a natural, healthy pride, okay? So your daughter climbs into your lap, and she's just beaming because she's drawn you this picture. Lewis says, well, that's commendable. That's a healthy, beautiful kind of pride. She's doing what she was made to do, and she's taking delight just in the thing itself. She was doing what God made her to do, and she's just so happy about it. And that's really, really good. But it's when her sister comes with another picture, and she starts comparing. And if her picture is worse, what does she do? Deflate. If her picture is better, what does she do? Starts getting a little patronizing, like, this was a very nice use of the crayon, but I would have blended it with some colored pencil, you know. This, you know. When is the last time you just took pleasure and joy in something you did for the sake of its own doing? Because it's just what God made you to do and who he made you to be, without any thought for what, how you rate compared to other people. So that's danger number one. Second danger, you will forget who you are. Verse 7, who sees anything different in you? That's what, I think that's the English Standard Version. The NIV, I think, says it better. It's just, what makes you different than anyone else? That's what he's saying. What makes you different than anything else? Did you forget that you're just a field? You're just a building? You're just a household? That it's the grace of God that actually makes everything about you holy and special and unique? What do you have, he said, that you didn't receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as though you didn't? I think especially, you know, especially if you're someone who lives a relatively comfortable life, you've done well, et cetera, et cetera, this is an important verse. Think about your life. Is there anything good or commendable in your life for which you are not completely dependent on the grace of God? I'm not saying you didn't work hard. I'm not saying you didn't persevere. I'm not saying you didn't make some good decisions. I'm just saying, who gave you the ability to make those good decisions? Who gave you your mind? Who gave you your strength? Who assigned you to a nation that still rewards hard work? When the grace of God is not at the center of your life, we forget that it's all grace. And we forget who we are. And then we go back to being puffed up. Do you see the connection? I have this vision of myself as a younger man that includes me being a tremendous athlete. It's kind of a joke on the staff team here. I keep reminding them that I was once a stud, a real stud. Now, what has happened is, and I grew up in a town of like 10 or something like, okay, very small town. But what has happened is I've taken that vision of myself and I'm putting it on my kids. And so I want them to be studs as well. Here's the reality. I play racquetball twice a week. I'm not even 40 yet. I play racquetball twice a week with a 51-year-old man. He beats me 8 or 9 times out of 10. That's not an exaggeration. That is a real number. I play with a 62-year-old man whom I have never beaten a single time in my whole life. On Friday, I went rock climbing for the first time. Now, I went rock climbing with my son once at a birthday party, and he didn't get very high, and I thought, what is the problem? What is your problem? Just climb the rock. Climb the rock. I came off the wall so fast on Friday that I literally lifted the guy holding me off the ground. He kicked me in the face. I've got a rug burn. You want to look at that baby right there. Look at that. All the way down my side. And I came home. I said to my son, I'm so sorry. Right, if the grace of God isn't like this, just everything about you, you're gonna forget and start filling your mind with visions of grandeur. And you know, when I was a kid, I could run a 10-second 100-yard dash, or you know, just foolish things. And rather than saying everything that I am is by grace, and I am Christ, and Christ is God's, and so are you. And look at what God has given you and how he's gifted you and so on and so forth. Anyway, danger 3, we will be far too easily impressed. Look at verse 8. He says, already you have everything you want. It literally means you're full. You're already full. Already you've become rich. Without us, you've become kings. He says, you're acting like you already reign. Like the kingdom of God has already come in its fullness. You have a few little spiritual gifts. Maybe we've had a few spiritual experiences, and you're acting like you rule the whole world. Maybe you have a little status in the world. You have maybe a position in the world or something like that. And you're thinking you are the cat's meow. And you're mistaking this bloated feeling for being full. That's what he says. You're already full. They're thinking, this is it. This is all that there is. And Paul is poking fun at them. He's saying, these little visions you have of your life, you have a few gifts, maybe a few cool experiences, and you're just so content with that. You just think this is all there is. When he says, everything is yours. And you are Christ's, and Christ is God's. And you are never going to get to the bottom of him. In 100 million, 1 billion, 1 trillion years, you will still not be bored with Jesus. We will still not have found the edge of him. And you're like little children, like splashing in this little puddle, like, oh, look at us, when there's an ocean of power and wisdom at your disposal. And that is what happens when anything but Jesus becomes the center of your life. You can get to the bottom of other things pretty quickly and think, oh, we may, I'm of Paul. I'm of Apollos. Yay. And he's saying, how lame is that? How pathetic a vision for your life in light of what we've just said. All things are yours. You are of Christ, and Christ is God's. If you are bored with Christianity, it's you. If you're bored enough to be picking fights about things that don't matter, you've missed something. Something's not connecting for you. Something other than God and what he's done in Jesus has taken center stage in your life, and you found the bottom, okay? You found the bottom, and where people don't agree with that, you're like, well, no, see, it's here. You're wrong. Whereas if Jesus is the, you know, you never find it. You never find the bottom of that. Here's how to know that you're full, according to what we read. You know you're full. You know you're feasting on the solid food of the gospel when you can lose everything and still be full. That's what he says. You know you're full when you can lose your dignity in the world, you can lose your place in the world, you can lose face inside of the world and still walk with courage because you know who you are. He says, if you can be cast out and misunderstood and still rest knowing you're at the center of God's power, you're full. If you can be mistreated and still treat people with grace, you're just full. You're off the chart full. He says, when reviled, we bless. When persecuted, we endure. When slandered, we entreat. We have become and are still like the scum of the world, the refuse of all things. How full do you have to be to live like that? How thick does grace have to be on your life to walk in the world like that without fear, without shame? Pretty full. In these verses, the Corinthians, they see themselves as filled and rich and ruling and wise and powerful and honored. Paul says we're weak and foolish and dishonored and hungry and poor and contemptible. And Jesus is still enough. When a Roman general would return from battle victorious, he would send ahead of him into the city. He would send all the spoils of war. And then he would follow with himself and his staff, and then the officers, and then the army behind them, and then way behind them, a train of slaves and conquered soldiers that were being drugged to the arena to be fed to beasts or turned into gladiators for the entertainment of all. Paul says, that's us. We've been put on display for the world to see. Not just the world, he says, but even angels. Could you do all that? Many, many weeks ago, back when we were in the book of James, we had a week where we talked about, you know, what would it look like to bring all of our stuff, all of our possessions to God and offer them back to him and say, this is yours. Do whatever you want with this. This week, I think that the invitation is the same, but to take our place in the world, take our honor, to take our reputation, the way that other people perceive us, the way that other people think about us, to lay it all before him and say, You could have all this too. You can have what people think about me and my reputation, my honor. I want Jesus. Would you make him enough for me? Would you make what he's done for me so real to me that even if I lose face before my family, you're enough? If I lose honor at work, you're enough. Would you fill me up to be that full? I want to invite, I'll invite the worship team to come on up. As we sing, we're going to sing just a minute. We're going to sing about justification by faith. And as we do, I want to invite you to press into that question a little bit this morning. Is the grace of God and what he has done for me in Jesus so real to me that I don't need to be honored by the world, but I'm not afraid of it either. I don't lust for recognition from my family or peers, but when it happens, I'm not embarrassed or afraid either. Wouldn't you love to walk by a mirror and not need to stop to admire yourself or to cringe? Wouldn't you love to just be free of yourself? I want to invite you as we sing to ask the Lord, make what Jesus has done so alive and real to me that I can be free. If I lost all my status and all my standing in the world, that Jesus would be enough.